CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast with your host, Jeff Stark.
And as I've said from day one of this show, this is a big tent hobby. There's a lot of room for folks.
And Larry Jewett.
And learning has been such a tremendous amount of this journey.
The CoinWorld Podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of the CoinWorld Podcast. I'm Jeff Stark.
And I'm Larry Jewett. Hope everyone's been having a great time as we go along here. Episode number 202. Oh, that's a nice ring to it for sure.
That's the New York City area code, right? So
I think either that or Washington. 212. 212 and one of them is 202.
Yeah.
That's not our specialty. We don't do area code world here. So
anywho. Well, we're sitting here after a meaningful and memorable Memorial Day weekend. I hope the listeners out there use the chance to mark the day in a meaningful way and maybe even use the long holiday to work on your collection. I know I got to do that a little bit with mine and did a fair bit of reading. Those holiday weekends are always a good time to pause and take stock and see where things are. It's hard to believe as this episode drops, we're in June already.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, one of the things typically from my background as a child growing up in Ohio, we used to always go to the Indy 500 when my dad would get off work and we'd drive over there. So it's still something that I have an interest in. I was watching it and it was kind of ironic to me that I watched the race and then afterwards went out and made a retail purchase. And what did I get back in change? An Indiana State quarter. And it was just like, okay, cool that, you know, looking at the back of it, seeing the race car and the whole works. That was
boogity,
pretty neat.
Boogity,
yeah, that Roan race, that got rained out and was run yesterday or on Monday. Keep in mind, it takes a few days here, but the Charlotte race was rained out and that one became a Monday thing. And I didn't even watch that. So wasn't interested in that. Just not, I mean, I know there's a NASCAR commemorative bill that's been proposed. Not sure how I feel about that, but we'll see how the legislature feels about that.
Well, you talk about the proposal for that. My last week, and I can say this because, you know, I'm just a member of Joe Public here. I sent a letter to the Citizens Stamp Advisory Committee proposing that in 2026, they come out with 10 stamps to mark the centennial of Route 66. There are 8 states that it cuts through. You can have one stamp for each of the 8 states touched by the Mother Road. You can have 2 designs emblematic of its history and its place in culture. I would love to see, and I don't know if it's appropriate or not, but I'm going to throw it out here. I'd love to, I don't want to necessarily use this bully pulpit as it were, but I would love to see a groundswell of support for a commemorative coin program for Route 66. Part of me wants it. Part of me also understands that that may not be of national import for a coinage program. That being said, if we're going to honor NASCAR, then why not Route 66? But it would take, and now's the time to do it, right? I mean, the we're 3 years out, 2.5 years out as this publishes roughly. So, you know, now's the time to get the legislation, go through the process. Then that would leave time for designs and all that to be done. I don't know. I wonder if I'm alone in thinking that would be fun or neat, just as somebody who grew up on the original route through St. Louis, 1926 to 1932. I literally grew up 20 steps from the road. So it has meaning to me. I know it has a lot of meaning to other folks. And, you know, there's folks that come from Japan and Germany and elsewhere to travel the road. And I've in the last month joined up with the Route 66 Association of Missouri. and I'm going to try to make their auto tour in September. So I don't know. I hadn't even thought about talking about it, but mentioned NASCAR and all this and that. I thought, why the heck not?
Well, I mean, and that even has more regional appeal than some of the programs that were introduced, albeit weren't successful. But I mean, that does, with the fact that it is part of the folklore of the character of the nation, and the fact that it does, in fact, touch 8 different states here that represents the heartland of the Americas. And a lot can be said because, you know, Route 66 basically served in a lot of ways to help the interstate highway system that President Eisenhower pushed through as well. So there's a lot of pop culture relationship here. And I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me, both as a stamp and as a commemorative coin, because of the nature of the history. And history is so very important to us, especially the history that leads to the development of the present time. So I think there's a lot of merit to that, as long as my voice holds up.
Well, no, I appreciate that comment. And I know that, or I suspect that a stamp program is much more likely. Just you look at, I am somebody who has, since joining Amos Media almost 20 years ago, I paid attention to stamps because of our sister publication, Lynn Stamp News, and Scott Stamp Monthly, which has been reborn here again recently, and of course the Scott catalogs. And you know, there are far more stamp programs in a given year touching on a thematic issue, so it's much more likely that there could be a stamp program. And but they have, like the coins, there's, you know, there's the Citizens Coinage Advisory Committee. Well, there's the Citizens Stamp Advisory Committee. In stamps, the CSAC, CSAC, they have more input as far as driving, no pun intended, the new issues that come out, than in the coin side, where you have the CCAC that weighs in on topics and designs. But those topics have to come from a congressional mandate, so there isn't that congressional mandate necessary in the stamp side of things. So it'll be interesting to see how things play out. Obviously, 2026, there's going to be a whole lot bigger fish to fry in both numismatic and philatelic worlds because of the 250th anniversary of the nation. But to me, it would still be neat to commemorate Route 66, hopefully both on a series of stamps and commemorative coins. I mean, and I don't know what the surcharges, what issuing authority or what partnership, you know, what organization should be the recipient for those funds yet. I haven't really dug into that, but that is a component of it as well.
Well, and you also, while with this conversation, it made me think about the stamp world and what they're going through, because, you know, we hear a lot of talk about the cashless society and making purchases with debit cards and that type of thing. And, you know, someday coinage is going to be eliminated. Well, I think back to how often I use a stamp these days. And truthfully, you know, it's not very often. I mean, I was faced with the opportunity today to utilize a postage stamp with an option of going online to transact what was necessary. And I went online, and I'm talking about the election for the ANA Board of Directors, the Vice President and President. I received that from the American Numismatic Association. I received the package in the mail over the weekend before the postal holiday on Monday, and it was sitting on the desk, and I looked at it, and I went, place stamp here? Nah, I got another option. And I went on, and I made my vote for President, Vice President, and the 7 governors, and that was it. And so I didn't have to use a stamp. And the guy, I got curious about it because we carry the stamps around in our car, and which is in the same folder as our coupons for the fast food restaurants, which is not relevant to the conversation. But anyway, just the idea, those stamps are from Christmas time. We still have stamps that we bought in December, and we didn't buy a bunch of them. We only bought 20 of them. We still have a bunch left from December. So, You know, stamp usage is not, you know, like it used to be. You know, I remember when I was a stamp collector as a kid, the 4-cent Lincoln stamp, the purple one, I mean, that was a big deal to me. And I was more into the world stamps than I was into the American stamps. But still, the idea that the stamp folks are going through the same problems we're going through as far as the efforts to eliminate the product from the general existence. I mean, postage meters came along and that took care of the stamp on that end. And now, you know, here I am with an option of not using a stamp and I choose that route. So, you know, there are quite a few options where if I don't have the money in my pocket, I have to use the other route when it comes to the coins. But it's just the idea that our society changed so much, and that's why we need to preserve the ideas of things like Route 66. And let me go ahead and utilize this platform and this time to remind members of the American Numismatic Association, it is your responsibility to select the leadership of the organization. If you're going to be a part of it, I mean, certainly you have a responsibility as well. I just recently reread an editorial comment from a couple of years ago about how few voters actually voted in the ANA election. And honestly, this was my first opportunity to vote in it because my membership didn't allow me that because I hadn't been a member long enough. So for those of you who are eligible to vote in this election, please do. I mean, that's just the idea because, you know, these individuals are committed to making a mark on an organization that means a lot to us. If we take the time to be members of it, let's be active members and vote in the election. And soapbox now been kicked to the corner.
All right. I am planning on voting, although I have yet to receive the ballot. I suppose I could go online, but I'm still very much an on dead tree person and clean.
Well, you wouldn't have the code yet, so, and I'm not going to give it to you.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't want to use your code. That would invalidate your vote, maybe. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, because the election's not held in Chicago. So,
we'll know soon enough the results of that. I suppose we should know real soon the results of our exploration into history, talking about history and Route 66 and all that. I want to go back in time and look at this week in numismatic history, hop in the Corvette with, was it Rod and Todd or Todd and Buzz? Todd and Buzz. Rod yep. And Todd's the Simpsons. Anyway, Todd and Buzz, we're going to hop in the car and go back in time to 1967, June 2nd, to be exact. That was when Canada approved the production of pure nickel 10-cent coins and 25-cent coins to replace the silver versions. Now, the curious thing about this, you know, the U.S. made the switch starting with 1965 dated 10-cent and 25-cent coins and 50-cent coins. They went from 90% silver on the two denominations to a copper nickel clad, and they went to 40% silver with the half. Canada, it took a few more years before they made the switch, although when you understand the history of how the change happened in the U.S., you understand that it wasn't as simple as 1965 versus 1967. They were still striking 1964 dated coins into 1965 or 66, I believe. So it was the window was narrower than it appears just by looking at the dates on the coins, right? What's interesting, and the reason I highlight this connection for this week in numismatic history, is many people do not know, but the Philadelphia Mint had a hand, the Canadian Mint had a shortage of operational shortage. They had to enlist the Philadelphia Mint to strike the 10-cent coins. And in 1967, for the centennial of Canadian Confederation, say that three times fast, they had a series of fantastically designed coins. We've talked about them on the show before. Well, because of the price of silver, they had to go from 800 fine to 500 fine silver in that year. So there are two versions out there of 1967 dated Canadian coins, of the ones that were struck in silver. The cent is not, the nickel is not. Well, in 1968, they made the transition from 500 fine silver to copper nickel, and that was the aforementioned change or approval that came on June 2nd, 1967. That took until 1968 to accomplish. But part of 1968, the Philadelphia Mint made 10-cent coins for Canada. There is a way to tell the difference between the two, the ones struck in Ottawa and the ones in the U.S. It's apparently, if you look at the grooves on the edge, I've never sat there and spent all that time to look and try to figure out the difference. And, oh, this is U.S. made, this is Canadian made. That seems a little beyond my interest level, but I'm sure somebody out there has done it and knows how to do it much quicker than I would take to the task if enlisted in that that task. So I thought, hey, you know, how many people know A, that the U.S. Mint struck coins for other countries, B, specifically, you know, Canada, our neighbor, and it was in this time of flux as nations around the world made the transition as the price of silver just, you know, silver priced itself out of coinage around the world. And so that was this week in numismatic history.
That's interesting to me. And I'm going to dig into my Canadian coins when I get done with the podcast here, because, you know, that is kind of an interesting concept. I knew about some of the other countries, but I don't think I ever knew about Canada. So that's just kind of where I want to go with that one. Just the idea that you have some information. This is always one of my favorite parts, to hear some of the things that happen in the numismatic history that, you know, we don't get lost because of the significance of the achievement here. And this is one that it's one of those, huh, I didn't know type things. So that leaves us with our next installment. And I do believe we're going to be going to, I hope that I picked the right issue. I'm thinking June 2nd, 2008.
Yes, random number generator came up with 2008. There really wasn't any other reason we went with that. But I love the story on the cover from our colleague Paul Jilks about scuba divers finding rare branch mint gold. This was coins from Dahlonega, Georgia, Charlotte, North Carolina, and New Orleans, Louisiana, that were found in 2007 in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of Louisiana. They also recovered a nearly complete collection by date of capped bust half dollars, which are, of course, in silver. These coins were recovered from the 1846 wreck of the SS New York. The company finding or recovering these, rather, was Gentlemen of Fortune, LLC. Four divers, including a sugarcane farmer and his wife, a mechanical engineer and consultant. I want to say that there is a book out there by Q. David Bowers on the SS New York find. There's been so many shipwreck finds, even in an American context, and many of these have been memorialized in numismatic literature. I'm pretty sure that this was covered in one of those books, tougher to find. It's not as well known as, say, the SS Central America, but shipwreck stories are fun nonetheless. So that to me was, you know, yes, it's front page news in this issue. It's, you know, in hindsight, it's not as big as, like I say, the Central America find or anything, but it's still pretty fun. And you know, that was what I wanted to talk about. What about you on the letters page, Larry?
Well, going to the letters page, the majority of the letters, or the most common subject on the letters, was about problems that the Bureau of Engraving and Printing had with their website. Well, that's kind of not relevant. I don't want to, you know, conjure up the bad juju, because we went through what was going on with the website with the Mint. Things are seem to be stabilizing there. So I don't want to have any kind of website problems. So the one I liked, the letter of interest I found, was called Beautify Circulating Coins. The letter starts out, I read with great interest, the May 19th Coin World article quoting U.S. Mint Director Edmund Moy saying how much he would like to see a coinage artistic renaissance, and coin redesign. Where is it then? Although the obverse of the 5-cent coin was nicely redesigned, we still have the stale bland rendition of Monticello from 1938. None of our circulating coins, except for the dollar and the quarter dollar, fare much better. In contrast, the reverse of the collector versions of the American Eagle Platinum coin designs get gorgeous new designs every year. This is how our circulation coinage should look. Circulation coinage is what people see, not platinum coins. The platinum coins get all the fanfare, but the really important circulation coins do not. What got me interested in coin collecting as a child was the beautiful coins then in circulation. The Indian head 5-cent piece, the winged Liberty head dime, standing Liberty quarter dollars, and walking Liberty half dollars. Do I just have to buy gold and platinum coins to enjoy these lovely designs? We didn't even have bullion coins then, and the hobby was just as exciting as now. I believe even more so. Now all the emphasis is on the big bucks. I enjoy beauty in coins, and our pocket change could emphasize this. I believe the Mint Director has his priorities somewhat confused as to what to redesign. Why can't the silver American Eagle ever have its reverse redesigned? Well, they did. The only thing they did for the back of the silver American Eagle basically is change the form of the letter U. And that's from Bob Olickson out of the Cleveland suburb of Parma, Ohio. So yeah, that was a good letter right there. Appreciate having that one along. And there was another one, overjoyed with mint mistake. I called the United States Mint and ordered an uncirculated 2008 W American Eagle silver coin. Coin came today, May 7th. When I opened it, there was the coin bearing the reverse of 2007. This is the first time I ever got a mint error. I was overjoyed. I thought that the mint errors went halfway around the world. Been buying from the Mint since 1999, and this is the first time this has happened. I just want your readers to know it can happen. And that was from Joseph out of West Palm Beach, Florida. So kind of interesting there, talking about a couple of different letters, a couple of different priorities here, and interesting indeed from 2008.
Yeah, absolutely. 15 years ago now. I was remarking or reminiscing looking in that issue, because you know there were other pieces that I wrote back in the day, and was just like, wow, I kind of remember some of that, and some of it I don't remember at all. It was so long ago in so many respects. Now, it was not all that long ago that I asked you a trivia question, right?
I agree.
So it is time now for the answer. Last episode, because we were dwelling in Chicago in our discussion anyway, I wanted to talk about something related to Chicago. And I believe I mentioned the Great Chicago Fire. I know it was mentioned in the interview. And the fire led to there's a numismatic connection to the fire, shall we say. Post-fire, there were medals made that sort of memorialized the fire, and there was something special about these medals, and that specialness, uniqueness, you could almost say, is a specific classification of objects in the hobby. So I'm dancing around what this is, because I have to be careful, I can't divulge it. Do you have any idea what made these medals so special and what they are? And again, I said it has application to other events, not just the Chicago Fire. So don't get locked in on that aspect. Do you have any idea?
The only thing I could think of maybe was that the coins were actually struck from metal that was in the fire itself. I think I read somewhere about a bell or something, but that may be totally left field. I'm not even sure.
Well, you're right. Do you know what those are called?
Oh, no, I call them. Okay. Yeah.
So when you have a medal made in a historical context like that from metal, M-E-D-A-L, M-E-T, T-A-L, metal, then that object is known as a relic metal, M-E-D-L. Oh. Because it is a relic of the event that occurred. One of the most accessible, affordable, fun relic metals out there. I don't remember when it was issued, but you can find it, you know, $5 to $20, depending on where you're looking. And when I find it for cheap, I try to hoard it when I come across it. Is a metal using metal from the USS Constellation or Constitution, one of the oldest ships in the American Navy. And when I went to Boston, I think it was, is that where it is moored?
Yes.
When I went there with my family in 2014, we toured the ship and they were selling a modern version of a relic metal made, again, using metal recovered from the ship when it was being refurbished. So there's several of these over the years. Relic metals are a fun area. Hey, maybe that's a good back to basics in the monthly issue if we haven't already tackled it. Seems like we would have, but who knows? So anyway, that was the answer. So I'll give you half the credit. You got one out of two right. Hey.
Yeah, and I learned a new term, so that's good thing there. Yeah, so that's definitely whenever I can learn something, even if I'm wrong on the question, just learning something is always nice for me.
Absolutely. And because we're talking about Nottgeld with Nathaniel Butler, author of Nottgeld German Series Notes 1918 to 1922, interviewed just a moment, I wanted to talk about a specific type of Nottgeld or a specific issue of Nottgeld, I should say. Nottgeld, in Nathan's perspective, is paper, but there was also, there was silk, there was other objects, but there was metal was used to make Nottgeld. So there's a very famous issue of metallic Nottgeld that features a famous German composer. Who is the famous German composer depicted on the Nottgeld? I'm not going to tell you where it was issued, when it was issued, but it's a fun little piece and they're very affordable. This is sort of, it's not really a numismatic question in the sense of, okay, what year was this issued and all that, but it's fun. It relates to numismatics. It relates to Nottgeld. We don't talk about that in our interview. Maybe though you will learn a lot listening to the interview here, that is. The Coin World podcast is delighted today to be joined by Nate Butler, author of a new book called Nottgeld, German Series Notes, 1918 to 1922. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Hey, so somebody who maybe spends all their time delving into the wonderful arena or array of U.S. coins might not have heard of Nottgeld. What is a elevator speech definition? What do you tell people when they ask you what you're interested in and they go, what's that?
Yeah, great question. So essentially, Nottgeld is a very broad range of currency. It basically means emergency currency of one sort or another. It could be coins, it could be paper. It could be vouchers, it could be receipts, but generally speaking, coins and banknotes are usually the most common. What I collect and what my book is about is the paper version of Nottgeld. Specifically, one small category in a broad range of categories related to Nottgeld. And essentially, those are probably the most popular, the type that my book is about, which are the series Nottgeld that were released in sets and were collected pretty heavily at the time by contemporary collectors in Germany from 1918 to 1922. But essentially, the most cool looking, colorful, collector oriented Nottgeld are the ones that I collect and the ones that my book are about.
Awesome. So you noted 1918 as the starting point, but Notgeld, I understand, and your book addresses this. Actually, it has origins a few years before that.
Correct. Yeah. And outside of the world of just German Notgeld, when we Notgeld was not exclusive to Germany. They were created and used by other countries as well. You know, Austria, France. So when we talk specifically about German Notgeld, those started in 1914, and towards the end of 1914, I believe the first one was issued in September 1914, and those were created very specifically and exclusively for an emergency situation where there was not enough coins in circulation for commerce to continue to exist. So they needed to do something quickly. And, you know, it was pretty much a free for all. Any individual person, business, organization could and did start making their own money just so that they could get by. And that only lasted for, you know, maybe a year and a half until the latter part of 1915. And by then, usually, you know, those were pretty much not necessary anymore. And the government had started to get a hold back on, you know, creating enough money for the economy to continue to run smoothly enough. And then shortly after that, there were new issues that came around. And essentially, there's these different waves of Notgeld that happen from 1914 all the way up until the start of hyperinflation, you know, 1923, 1924. And within that span of time of roughly 10 years, there's, you know, more than a half dozen different categories of Notgeld. And then within those, there's dozens and dozens of subcategories. It's just a huge, incredibly vast field to get into. So, you know, that's one of the tricky parts of getting into Notgeld collecting is first making sense of the landscape. But once you do that, and I've tried to do that as well as I could in the introductory section of my book. But once you start getting a grasp on that, then you can figure out, okay, what area kind of interests me the most, or where do I want to start to focus in a bit? Because a Notgeld collection without focus is going to be a messy thing.
So here we are 5 minutes into this, and I've learned four different things right off the bat, because I was one of those guys on the periphery that thought everything was German. And now you've already dispelled that. Were you aware of how deep this, some would say, rabbit hole was when you started getting involved in Notgeld?
Not initially, because, I mean, essentially my progression was, what the heck are those? Those look so cool, which I think is the reaction of almost anyone that comes across some Notgeld for the first time. They look beautiful. They're really interesting. It's almost like, I can't believe that's money. And it draws you in immediately. But then taking that next step, especially for folks who are outside of Europe, perhaps don't speak any German, taking that next step to find that information, to even know that that vast landscape exists, has been very, very difficult up until now. You know, there's a little bit of information online where you can learn about that, different collector groups, but, you know, it's tricky. So I would say after starting to collect them fairly obsessively for, I don't know, 6 months, that's when I really started to get a better understanding of, wow, this is incredibly vast. It's so vast, in fact, that one category of Notgeld, which is the inflationary notes in 1923, there are so many examples that only one publication has ever been written about them by kind of the godfather of Notgeld collecting, Dr. Arnold Keller. And no one has been able to publish anything else on the topic since, because it's too complicated. There's estimated to be over 80,000 different issues of Notgeld in that 1 year alone.
Holy crud.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'm a nice, well-rounded world coin guy and all that, and I know about Notgeld, and I have some, and I have, this year I got a bunch of the books published by Gitto at the Berlin show. I don't have a full set of like all 15 volumes or whatever, but I have like half of it. I didn't realize the inflationary was just that huge. That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. And they published a reprint of Arnold Keller's catalog on that topic. But yeah, it's crazy. That particular span of time is wild. But those books published by Gietel have been the standard for so many collectors, but it's been so difficult to find them outside of Europe. Like you mentioned, you bought them in Berlin. I didn't even know they existed until I'd been collecting Nacka for a few years. And I was only able to acquire enough of them to start, you know, being a serious collector because I knew someone who happened to have some extra copies and they were willing to sell them to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's been really difficult to find material, which was one of the main reasons why I wanted to write this book.
So we're going to talk about the book more in a minute, but I want to find out when you started your collecting journey period, you didn't just start with Nottgeld, did you? Were you a U.S. collector of some type or some sort?
Yeah, I've been one of the weirdo obsessive collector types ever since I was a little kid, starting out with, you know, I think marbles was probably the first thing I ever collected, and I still do. And anything from, you know, Pogs to comic books. But I started getting into coins when I was, you know, maybe 11, 12 years old, because my dad was, you know, very cordial with a lot of the local clerks at various stores. And he knew that, or they knew that he collected coins. And so they would put things aside for him. And whenever we would go around to different stores running errands, they would often give him something that they set aside for him. And then he would teach me about what it is that they had given him. And that's kind of how I got into it. And it turns out my dad got into it from my grandpa, who had a pretty cool collection himself, which I inherited. And so U.S. coins have always been there as part of my life, and I still collect them. But for me, I'm a graphic designer professionally. I've been so for about 17 years now. I went to art school and I've been started as a graphic designer, and then became an art director, and now I'm a creative director. That's my day job. And that was really the reason why I got into Nottgeld, because the designs of the pieces are so nice. A lot of the typography on them feels incredibly modern, like it could be created today, and I would never second guess it. A lot of the illustration is just fantastic. A lot of the illustration, you know, it's rumored that it inspired a lot of the early Disney illustrators, and you can definitely see some through line there. It's just really, really nicely designed, beautiful currency.
As one who does work in the graphic design field in the modern days, I think you can also get a sense of appreciation for the process that had to be used to create these items over 100 years ago.
Yeah. Definitely, especially some of the printing techniques. You know, they were experimenting with wild materials. You know, they printed on aluminum foil. And not only is it hard to find those pieces still intact today because they were incredibly thin and fragile, but I don't even know how they came up with that idea in the first place. They printed on silk, linen, leather, all sorts of different materials. And many of those are listed in my book, but yeah, there's something for everyone in knockout collecting, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's just so fun to get into.
That's
you were one of the individuals who got involved because of the design of it. Do you think that a lot would be interested in because of the historic aspects of it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The random emails that I get or people contacting me through various forums or whatever, it's almost always from the historical perspective. Some of that might be because of the worries about inflation getting out of control these days. But I think a lot of people are just really fascinated by that time in history, you know, starting from the early 20th century up until now.
I was aware of the silk issues, like for Bielefeld. I think that's how you pronounce it. I didn't realize the aluminum foil ones. I guess those aren't around anymore because somebody wrapped up their dollar roll sandwiches. But I'm
No, so there's some somewhat common ones or somewhat more easy to find notes that were printed on you know, like you're describing your typical silver aluminum foil, but they even have notes that were printed on, you know, gold aluminum foil or purple aluminum foil. Oh. There's a lot of different colors and variations that, and new discoveries all the time. So, yeah.
So with a lot, you say new discoveries, with a lot still being learned, the process to develop this book had to be an enormous task and a challenge. I think you cataloged somewhere around 1,400 pieces. What were the biggest challenges and what motivated you throughout this process?
Yeah, so it was incredibly difficult. I think I averaged, you know, maybe 2 to 3 hours a night for 3 years, every single night. And a lot of that was because I did literally every part of the book myself. I scanned thousands of images, processed them. I, you know, wrote every word, did all the translation, did all the layout, blah, blah, blah. So that's time consuming, obviously, but just the sheer volume of notes, you know, including, so the 1400 number that you mentioned is 1450-ish issuing authorities.
Okay.
Within those issuing authorities, there's over probably 8,000 different varieties, and that's not even including any of the nitpicky varieties that you might find in one of the specialist catalogs, like from Kai Lindman. So yeah, there's a lot, and it took a lot of work. Thankfully, there's a ton of really great reference materials out there in German that I've been able to acquire over the years that helped out tremendously. Wouldn't be possible without those, but you know, it was a lot of work.
What made you decide that you were going to take the step from a collector to an actual author to write such a complete reference book like this?
The main driver was probably frustration. I was frustrated that it had taken me so long to learn basic stuff about collecting this material, and that I just kind of got lucky in that I happened to meet a knockout collector locally who, you know, grew up in Germany, and then he just happened to be in my coin club, and I learned a ton of stuff from him, and I just felt like the stars kind of aligned to the point where not only do I have this context and this background, but also, okay, I'm also a graphic designer. I could literally make this book myself, I think, if I take the time to do it. And I felt like there were probably a lot of other people like me who, you know, didn't speak German, didn't necessarily want to go through and translate lines of text every time they wanted to learn about a note or look one up, and they happened to find a copy of one of the German texts. So there's just a lot of barriers to entry for people outside of Europe who don't speak German to learn and collect these effectively. And I felt like I couldn't be the only one that would speak to. So it took a bit of a gamble there, but that was really the main driver behind why I wanted to make this, because it's the catalog I wish I always had when I started out.
And how many copies of this catalog are now in the world for collectors to obtain?
There's a decent amount that so it's been officially released now for, I think, 3 weeks. And the amount that I was anticipating to sell in the first year, I've already almost met. So I've been pretty shocked at the reception and the enthusiasm behind it. And especially the feedback I've received so far has been just so, so positive. And yeah, just huge thank you to everyone who's been so supportive along the way. Especially folks like Joe Pilago at PCGS Banknote. Super supportive, such a great you know, mentor and supportive person in the industry.
Awesome. Do you have plans for, I know this is, every author hates to hear this. You just came out with this, but what's next? I mean, are you going to update it in a certain time frame? Are you going to explore some of those other areas outside of the series notes? Or are you just going to not rest on the laurels, but take a break because you've had this enormous task that you can now catch your breath on after doing it.
Yeah, I think both of those former options are possibilities. I think as long as the interest seems to exist, I think a second edition might be in order down the line. Especially if I'm really hoping that people contact me if they have a note that, you know, hasn't been cataloged before, or, you know, different varieties that I could include in the next version. That would be amazing. Especially, you know, obviously undiscovered notes are always very exciting. And there's a few of those in this book that have never been published before. And then also in that second edition, if I end up doing that, which I think I will, I'm going to end up including a lot of the stuff that just wasn't feasible to include this time around, like a lot of those in-depth serial number varieties and just a lot more varieties in general, as well as the envelopes that a lot of the sets were issued in originally. Those are really cool to collect, and probably more errors and proofs and stuff like that. So just a more expanded version. And then I am interested, and I do collect other types of Not Guild as well. So I might consider doing a catalog for one of those, but maybe one that it's a little less broad and crazy. It'd be nice to do a slightly shorter book next time around.
When you mention, I mean, now that you've gotten some success with this book, what has that done? Well, how has that impacted your own collecting? Did it reignite a passion? Did it diminish a passion? What effect did it have on you to have this book and complete it?
Probably the biggest thing for me is that I'm now in contact with so many more collectors and enthusiasts, and it's just fun to talk to them about this kind of stuff that we're both interested and excited about. So that's probably been the biggest change. I had, you know, fellow collectors who I talked to about collecting these notes, and a lot of whom helped me with the book in different ways, you know, providing scans or whatever. But just having more people to talk to and nerd out on this kind of stuff is awesome for me.
So, I love that you have the TO notes on the back of the book, because last Wednesday, as we're talking, I got to see a set of those in person at my Missouri Numismatic Society show meeting. And I was like,
really?
You're cool. What's that? And I learned the story of it, and I went, oh yeah, that's in the book. You go home and look it up, and it's like, that's really cool to see this extremely rare thing in person that, you know, I literally just learned about. Are you at all considering a transition into making a market for these on the dealer side so that people can find these more readily? Or is that you keen to just, keep the author part of the title and do the day job?
Yeah, I have entertained that. There are a handful of dealers in the U.S. that, you know, have nice inventory, but, you know, I do have, I guess it's probably safe to say, thousands of duplicate notes that I probably don't need to continue hoarding. So that has crossed my mind, and it's something I'll probably do at some point.
Yeah.
And especially just being able to provide that material to other collectors more readily is a great thing. That's interesting that you said that about the TO set, though. This person had all four notes?
I think so. I saw at least two of the notes.
Okay. I was going to say that's an incredibly scarce set to have all four. And I believe those notes on the back of my book, I believe that's the first time those images have ever existed on the internet.
They had the 20 and they had one or two others. I'll have to ask them. I'm pretty sure it was three or four. I my memory is horrible, but I saw the notes and I was really intrigued.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
What's kind of interesting about that, a little trivia bit, is the reverse design on the 100 TO note is actually a riff of a French piece of Not Guild from just after the war, and it's the exact same design, just co-opted by technically by the Americans for an event in Germany.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting connection there.
Absolutely. So, well, very cool. I am excited to have the book. I'm excited to have talked to you and to get the word out. You mentioned anybody with additions, corrections, updates, they can find you at notgeldbook@gmail.com.
Correct.
The website is?
Same thing, notgeldbook.com. Nice and easy.
Perfect. Thank you so much for being here today. This is really fun. I get to see these notes a lot of times when I go to the Berlin show, and I acquired a small handful of very, very common stuff. But the book is a visual treat, and I have pride of ownership in my numismatic library with it now. Thank you again.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate that.
And that was our interview with Nathan Butler, author of the new book about paper knot geld, specifically the German series notes of 1918 to 1922.
That's a beautiful cover on that book right there. I mean, and the information inside is bountiful, no doubt about that. But the cover of the book was put together. I mean, we didn't even talk about that and all the effort that went into it. But just the cover of that, I mean, that's impressive on a coffee table or on your bookshelf, no matter what you have destined for that book. You've got to get that book right there. Very interesting subject, but again, visually stimulating with the cover here. And, you know, as we know from the newsstand days, covers make a big difference. And once you get the eye attention there and then you get them to thumb through it and see what all's in it, it's a winner. So congratulations on a great effort by Mr. Butler.
Oh, yeah. It's I love the book, and I've already, as I've mentioned, I think I've had a local friend encouraged to buy it because he saw it and enjoyed it. So hopefully you enjoyed the interview. We learned a lot, and we always have fun bringing this kind of stuff to you. We got some good stuff lined up the next couple, 3 weeks already. And, you know, we're gonna be back here next week with another episode. We thank Coin World Plus, again, as always, for this sponsorship this week. And I don't know, there's you know, just another week moving forward. So hope everybody's getting ready for, you got summer fun. You got Whitman Baltimore's happening here real soon. It's a good time to keep taking stock of the hobby and learning something and having fun, right?
Yeah. It seems like every time you turn around, there's some place to go. I know the weekend, the Texas Numismatic Association having a big show. Us around here, we're looking forward to going back to Collectorama down there in Lakeland. Plus, you know, we got a lot of things that are happening with, it's just 6 weeks away from the Summer Fun Show for us locally here. So there's a lot going on. Hopefully there's a lot going on where you are locally as well. If not, just look around, because it's always a great time. There's a lot of small shows that happen on a given weekend. These small shows that are set up at American Legion halls or, you know, little meeting places right there. You know, it's just always a great experience. Just get out. And sometimes the big shows get a lot of attention, but the intimacy that you can get at the local shows and at the smaller shows goes a long way, because then the dealers and the exhibitors have more time to spend with you and help educate you and help make you informed decisions. So it's really, I mean, check your calendar. If you get an opportunity to get away, you don't have to travel by an airplane. You can just jump in a vehicle and get to where you need to go and have a good time. So make sure that you do enjoy the hobby for what it's for, and that's for enjoyment, information, education, and podcasts. That's the big things.
Absolutely. And of course, and I'll say all of this, until next time, happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next week.
Coin World Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about Coin World Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.